Thanks for joining us today. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting our show today by taking a look at the history and significance of the sport of lacrosse. Patty Lowe is our guest. Great to have her with us. She's a professor emerita in the Bedell School of Journalism at Northwestern University and the inaugural director of NU's Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. Patty's a citizen of Mushkezibee, or the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, and she produced a PBS Wisconsin documentary about lacrosse. It's called Sacred Stick, and it's a good one. So as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What do you know about lacrosse? Why do you love it? Has it played a role in your life? What do you want to know? Maybe you don't know anything about it and want to know the particulars. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Patty Lowe, welcome back.
Larry, it is so nice to hear your voice again. You're one of my favorite colleagues in the universe, so I'm really happy to be here.
Patty and I were colleagues for close to 20 years at the University of Wisconsin in life sciences communication. Oh, it's good to hear your voice, too, and I was really glad to have you on to talk about lacrosse. It's the aura, the history, and so forth of lacrosse has always been intriguing to me, and it's the oldest sport in North America, isn't it?
It is, and it's an indigenous originated sport. So it started here and it spread all over the world. And right now, the last time I checked, it was still the fastest growing sport in the world.
And I think it's doing very well here in Wisconsin, too.
It is, in both indigenous and non-indigenous communities. It's a fast-growing high school sport. But it also has had a resurgence in Native American communities who have gone back to playing it as a medicine game, a sacred game with all the cultural protocols, with wooden sticks that are handmade. And that's been really wonderful to see the explosion of lacrosse and the fact that Native American communities are taking it back.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are probably many people listening who aren't familiar with the game. So we'll start with the basics. What are there? 10 players to a side on the field at any one time?
Yeah, and a couple of goalies who, boy, you have to really, I'm the mom of a hockey goalie, and that's a really tough position to play. I mean, anybody that can stand up to 75-mile-an-hour, 100-mile-an-hour hard pucks or, you know, hard balls coming at them is, I don't want to say has a little screw loose in their head, but I sure wouldn't want to do that.
And the equipment, as you say, there's not a lot of equipment. I mean, they're the sticks, which have a little net.
They're usually aluminum sticks or plastic sticks with a netting. And it's kind of an elongated catcher, the catching part of it. And it's pretty much modeled after the sticks the Haudenosaunee made. And that's a community, like a lot of Native communities, that claims to be where the game originated. But my tribe has similar stories. And if you talk to the indigenous people who, from Aztec and Mayan cultures, there were ball games there at the, beginning of time. And we don't really know. There's a really good book written by Dr. Greg Gaetti called Spirit of the Game that talks about that and other indigenous sports. And, there may have been multiple origins for lacrosse. I mean, almost every culture has balls and sticks, and it's inevitable that some kind of game is going to be created from them.
Yeah, it kind of, in a way, it kind of reminds me of hockey.
It does, because there's action behind the net in both lacrosse and hockey, and some of the same rules apply. So if you like hockey, you probably will like lacrosse.
Yeah. Callie in Mequon has something for us. Callie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm so nervous. I've never called in before. I feel like a celebrity. The lacrosse is the reason my husband and I are married. My older brother played out east at a private school, and that's how he was introduced to it, more that affluent white body kind of exposure to lacrosse. Brought it out here to the Midwest when my parents got divorced, and the only reason I met my husband is because he co-captained the team with my younger brother, who played because my older brother played. So it's not lost on me, like, the cost prohibitiveness of the game and that, you know, our exposure to it is white bodies, but my husband, because it's been such an important game to our family, decided to go through the coaching process for our children. And it was the first time we were exposed to so many principles about appreciating your opponent versus annihilating your opponent. And just this gratitude, like you're calling it a medicine game, this gratitude that someone else shows up so that you can play and that you can get that medicine, as opposed to a lot of the competitiveness that is present in our other sports as an American, you know, what I'm exposed to. And it's just been a beautiful sport. One of the people who spoke at one of the tournaments expressed how we speak to our ancestors through the game, too. That when we touch the ground by our running or throwing the ball, they are brought joy by our presence, that we're like sort of signaling to them that we're there and that we're thriving. And that's a beautiful element to it as well.
Oh, Callie, thank you so much.
Just a beautiful story. And you know, that really kind of captures the spirit of the game for me. I've had the grace of being able to witness lacrosse games, or, you know, we call it Bagataway. It's lacrosse in our communities, but in other parts of the country, it's called stickball, or, you know, every Native community has its own name for it. But there's this underlying, and I think Kelly just described it so well, this underlying reverence, this understanding that you're playing this game and it's more than a sport. And, you know, in traditional times, Larry, we called it, translates to little brother of war, because lacrosse was a game historically that was used in place of war. If there were two communities that had a dispute, rather than going into battle, you know, it was the equivalent of, you know, taking it outside. And they would play a game rather than go to war, and the winner, you know, prevailed. So the other thing, you know, at some point I would love to tell you a story about the use of lacrosse during Pontiac's Rebellion to take Fort Michilimackinac. This is after the French and Indian War. It's a wild story.
and we will get to that. I do want to hear that story. Callie, thank you so much for your comments. Appreciating your opponent. That's a nice way to put it. Thank you again. Josie in Monona. Your turn. Hi, Josie.
I'm actually calling to talk about Fort Michilimackinac. I'm Sault Ste. Marie, Ojibwe, and my dad grew up on that. I was born and raised there. So I grew up on the story of the Bataguay game that took the fort. And so the irony of you mentioning that is fantastic. That has always been a huge part of my childhood, my life, knowing that story. So I love hearing about it, and I thank you for doing this show.
Josie, thank you so much.
But Josie, maybe if you grew up with it, you should tell the story.
I just know that, you know, we go up to the fort and to both Fort Mackinac on the island and Michilimackinac on the mainland. Most years of my childhood, and talking about, you know, they thought it was just going to be this friendly game between the Ojibwe and the Sauk, and that the commander should have seen the warning signs of this was going to be an attack, and the fact that they tossed the ball over the fence and went in. And the women pulled out all of the weapons from their dresses. And it was an absolutely flawlessly executed attack. that started as what seemed like a friendly game. And it's a fantastic story.
Yeah. You know, Larry, sometimes it's the big brother of war, not the little brother of war. And you know, after the French and Indian War, the French had to turn over all 14 forts to the British. And the native people around those forts didn't much care for the English. They much preferred the French, who extended credit and were kind of loose and chill. And so Pontiac organized this taking of all 14 forts on the same day so the British couldn't send reinforcements. And my tribe and the Sauk were tasked with taking Fort Michilimackinac. So we informed the fort that we were going to play lacrosse for the amusement of the troops on the king's birthday. And the plan was the women who were watching the game had blankets and weapons hidden underneath their blankets. And the third time, there was the plan that the ball would, go over the fort picketing, you know, the first time, go over the second time. And the third time, they would attack the fort. Well, the third time the ball went over the picketing, a British soldier actually opened up the gates to the fort. And the whole thing was over in 12 minutes, according to Alexander Henry, who wrote a book, which is in the rare book collection at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He survived by hiding under the dirty laundry of the wife of Charles Langley, from Langley County. So just one of my favorite stories.
Oh, boy. Josie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, number 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Kathy in Lac des Flambeaux, we'll give you a chance. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Lacrosse was very big in our family. My son, when he was 12 or 13 years old, took up lacrosse. We belonged to Congregation of the Great Spirit in Milwaukee, and then there were other churches, and the people from those churches would socialize a lot, and they got together a lacrosse game. I believe it was Mark Denning who was his teacher.
Oh, Mark Denning, yep.
Yes, and he loved it, and then he eventually got married, and there's two boys came with the marriage, and so our sons, and his sons, and they both took up lacrosse, and I believe it helped very much socialize them where they were comfortable around other people more, and one of them is a musician now performing. He went to Chicago Youth Symphony Program. I don't have the exact name of that, but they sponsor the musicians, but I think it really gave him a lot of security.
Oh, Kathy, thank you so much. Comment?
Yeah, discipline and respect for your opponents and tradition and history. A lot of times these young children on Native reservations across the country are playing with sticks their grandfathers or their fathers carved for them. And again, there's that reverence and that connection to their creator. It's called the creator's game in many communities because it's there are some really old, beautiful stories about how lacrosse originated. And a lot of times it's a connection with the other world. And so I just love to hear comments like Kathy's about, you know, the fact that her boys grew up playing it and learned discipline and teamwork and, you know, develop that reverence for the game and for their landscape.
Yeah. Kathy, thank you so much for calling. Patty Lowe, our guest today, Professor Emerita in the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. She put together a wonderful documentary on the game of lacrosse, and it's great to have her with us. You have an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Our technical director is A. Emily Ralph. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Patty Lowe, our guest today. We're talking all about lacrosse and its history with Patty. And I hope you'll join in. Number 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. John wanted you to, in an email, to talk more about how some consider lacrosse to be healing and spiritual.
One of my favorite stories comes from the Passamaquoddy. It's about this young boy who disappears every night, and it's a very involved story, so I'm giving you the Reader's Digest highlights.
Okay.
And his father tries to follow him, but always loses him. And then one day he's successful, and he follows him across the Milky Way, which is the path of souls in some Native communities, the entrance to the other world. And he sees his son lit up playing lacrosse. And eventually the reader understands, or the listener of the story understands, that this is the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. And, so there are these beautiful kinds of stories that connect lacrosse to a spiritual realm. But the way that I have learned about lacrosse in Haudenosaunee communities, these are the Haudenosaunee Nationals, formerly the Iroquois Nationals, and in some of the Ojibwe and Menominee communities, Stickball and Cherokee and some of the other southeastern communities, is that from the beginning of carving the sticks, which come from plant relatives, and sowing special medicines. For example, if you're hoping to emulate the agility of an animal, like speed of a rabbit, maybe you sow some fur into the ball that you're creating. There are ceremonies of dipping lacrosse sticks in sacred waters. And the first caller who described the reverence of respecting your opponent, all of these things go into the game of lacrosse, which sometimes was played for miles. the entire city of Chicago was one big lacrosse field at one time, I was told. It's really difficult to, and really it's probably not my place to talk about the spiritual traditions of other communities, and I won't do that, but there are 573 federally recognized Native nations and a whole bunch of state recognized tribes. They all have some, most of them, I won't say all, but many of them have some version of a game that we would recognize as lacrosse. So, I'm super excited about this. I've been advising the Field Museum, which has a new lacrosse exhibit that's going to open in May, on May 14th, I think. So, my mind is just filled with facts and figures and thoughts about lacrosse. If you can tell, I'm pretty charged about it.
Well, and the opening happens on my actual birthday, so there you go.
Oh, all right.
Well, has been a professional league.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, back when the settlers first arrived, they saw Native people playing lacrosse and they learned the game and played against them. But of course, they weren't nearly as good as the Native men. It was primarily a men's game that they played against. And they developed an amateur lacrosse association back in the mid-19th century. and specifically excluded Native Americans. we're gonna borrow this game from you, and then we're going to exclude you from playing. Perhaps because they knew that the Native Americans would probably beat them. But this continued, Larry, until the 1980s, where lacrosse, USA Lacrosse, would not let the Haudenosaunee, then called the Iroquois Nationals, play. Part of it was because the Haudenosaunee, we don't call them Iroquois anymore because it was a disparaging word that, you know, the Algonquin people, the language that my folks speak, gave to the Six Nations people. And the Iroquois Nationals renamed themselves Haudenosaunee Nationals 2 years ago. But these are communities that straddle Canada and the United States. So the Haudenosaunee Nationals have players from both countries. And USA Lacrosse wanted them to declare either I play for Canada or I play for the U.S. And the Haudenosaunee Nationals say, no, we're a sovereign people and we want our own team. We travel on our own passports. And of course, after 9/11, it got really tricky. And they were finally allowed to play in international competition. And you referenced the documentary that I did. It focused on the 2007 Indoor National Lacrosse Championships. And the Haudenosaunee Nationals actually beat Team USA and took Team Canada to overtime. So they are very competitive. They're making plans to play in the 2028 Olympics, which is the first time lacrosse will be played in the Olympics. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens because there are all these questions about whether the United States and Canada and other countries will recognize the sovereignty of the Haudenosaunee people. So we'll see.
Interesting storyline. And the Olympics are coming up pretty darn quickly. So... it's something to follow. There was as you mentioned Canada, of course, and Canadian George Beers, I think, is recognized as the person who recorded the rules of lacrosse.
Yep.
How did that influence the game?
Well, it was the way the Native people played it was pretty intense. I mean, it was not at all uncommon for people to break their legs and break their arms, and some people even died playing it. So the amateur lacrosse rules sort of civilized the game and made it more palatable for Western audiences.
And so it's in some ways a kind of a different game then.
Yeah. It went from a no holds barred kind of free-for-all to, well, you can't hit someone with your stick, you know, in this place, and it just toned it down quite a bit. You know, one of my favorite stories about lacrosse came from my mentor, the late Joe Rose, who is an amazing man at Bad River. And he talked. I was doing a documentary about Native baseball because there were all these Native men who wound up in the Baseball Hall of Fame. One of whom was a pretty famous pitcher by the name of Chief Bender. And I asked Joe why there were so many good Native baseball players, and he said they used to, when he was a kid, they would do batting practice with lacrosse sticks. And even an 11-year-old kid could hurl an almost 95, mile an hour fastball. And if you can hit a ball like that, you probably are going to find some success in Major League Baseball. So lacrosse keeps popping up in all kinds of interesting places for me.
Rick in Madison has something for us. I think Rick's one of your former students. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Bonjour. I just wanted to, I've done some research as far as lacrosse goes as well. And you covered part of it of like where fields didn't end, like all of Chicago. But I was just wondering for the other callers that if you could just bring up like what does the Wisconsin Historical Society have as far as artifacts and accessibility to it?
You know, I don't think I can answer that question. My research on lacrosse was for a documentary, so I was looking primarily for photographs, and they do have some photographs of lacrosse in their iconography collection, but I never looked specifically for actual artifacts.
Hmm.
So that would be a good thing. If anybody knows the answer to that question, I'd be interested to know, too. I can tell you what the Field Museum is. I've been knee-deep in their archive for the last 2 years working on this lacrosse exhibit.
Well, Rick, do you have some knowledge of it?
I've seen a few artifacts at the Historical Society. I've seen maybe one stick and a few balls that were tarred twine.
Tar?
Week old and tar. That was the ball.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, Patty, you can talk about what the people would find at the Field Museum.
Oh, I mean, there were scores of sticks that we looked through. We were trying to create as diverse an exhibit as possible. It's the first rotating exhibit in the Native Truths Hall, which is a huge exhibit that 165 Native people contributed to. And there's very little third-person information in there. It's all first-person stories, multimedia. It's really, I think it's a really, really good exhibition. And it also, what I appreciate the most is it has a much-needed, long-awaited apology from the field for the really problematic, unscrupulous collecting methods that they had for decades. The lacrosse exhibit will feature sticks from southeastern communities like the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Seminole. It will feature, I know we picked the Menominee stick. It has Haudenosaunee sticks. It has a number of different balls. It has double balls and related games that were played like lacrosse in other Native communities. And we were working on a virtual exhibit as well. There's tons and tons of stories from people, celebrations of community figures like Orrin Lyons, who was the kind of the godfather of the Haudenosaunee Nationals and the first Native person inducted into the lacrosse, the National Lacrosse Hall of Fame. There's just going to be a lot to this exhibit. It's pretty exciting.
It is. Rick, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You could join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. You know, the sovereignty, the broader idea of sovereignty often comes up, and I think it's a complex subject, but what does the word sovereignty mean, and how does it relate to Native Americans?
Well, sovereignty is self-determination. When the first European settlers arrived on this continent, they realized that there were people living there that had possession, and I don't want to say ownership because that wasn't traditionally the way indigenous people thought about the land, but they realized that the native people used it and possessed it and lived on it and realized that they, if they wanted it, they had to either go to war over it or sign treaties. But the act of treaty making, and this was the method that, you know, millions, hundreds of millions of acres were transferred from indigenous communities to what became the federal government, they had to sit down and negotiate as equals. So they realized that these were people who possessed sovereignty and had the authority to either sell the land or be ripped off of it, ripped off from it. So that act of sitting down and negotiating was an inherent recognition of sovereignty. In the U.S. Constitution, there's a line that says treaties are the supreme law of the land. So the treaties that were negotiated with these Native communities are legal. They don't have an expiration date. And that's something that was never given up. And the United States has a nation-to-nation relationship with the 573 federally recognized Native tribes.
It's a big topic, and you did a really nice job of summarizing that very tough topic in a pretty short period of time there, Patty. So thank you so much for that. I appreciate that much very much. Well,
if I can add to that,
sure.
If we have time. One of the things that was really interesting is that, you know, in 1924, the United States conferred Indian citizenship on Native people. It was largely because of the contributions that people like my grandfather made in enlisting and fighting in World War I. Veterans, those Native veterans, received citizenship in 1921. In 1924, it was extended to all Native people. The Haudenosaunee were very upset because they felt it was an infringement of their sovereignty. They didn't want to be citizens of the United States. And what was really interesting in World War II, when Selective Service made all Native and non-Native men eligible for selective, you know, to be enlisted in the military, the Haudenosaunee went to the U.S. court to say, no, we, you know, you don't have the right to tell us as a sovereign nation that we have to serve in your war. Even as their chiefs were standing on the U.S. Capitol, telling the steps of the Capitol, telling young Haudenosaunee men to enlist in the United States military. They didn't want to be drafted. I mean, they felt that they had the right to say, no, you don't have the legal authority to draft us. But at the same time, they declared war independently on the Axis powers and served in the U.S. military. So it's a really interesting relationship there. And sovereignty is a complex concept.
Oh, Patty, it is indeed a very complex topic. Just on lacrosse, you know, we've talked mostly about men and lacrosse.
Mm-hmm.
What about the women's game? I know the women play.
Absolutely. And there's a beautiful sketch in the Wisconsin Historical Society done by Seth Eastman of women playing. I think it's Seth Eastman. Don't quote me on that. but it's this scene in a wide lacrosse field of Dakota women playing lacrosse. So, you know, there's evidence going that suggests that even before settlers arrived, women were playing the game as well.
So it's not the sole. Not only the men are playing
it. Right.
And the women have been.
Everybody's. Right. And then you look at lacrosse being played at the collegiate level by female athletes, and that's really exciting. There are some really excellent lacrosse out there.
Yeah. It's exciting to see this sport which it's our oldest sport, and it took a dip for a while, but now it's really exciting to see the excitement surrounding it and the large number of people who are playing it now. Patty, it's been a real pleasure to be able to talk with you, and I have to mention and congratulate you on being, you'll be inducted into the Wisconsin Broadcasters Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I guess the nomination list was a bit thin this year, huh?
No. You've done a wonderful job in your entire career, and it's been always been fun working with you, and it was particularly fun to have you on today to talk about lacrosse. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
Patty Lowe, Professor Emerita in the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, inaugural director of NU's Center for Native American and Indigenous Research. And prior to that, she was a faculty member here at the University of Wisconsin in my home department, Life Sciences Communication. And we were together and colleagues for 18 or 20 years or so. So it was really fun to get back with her. I hadn't talked to her in a long time. Hopefully we'll get together for some golf this coming summer. Oh, we're going to turn our attention to basketball and March Madness, and we'll talk a bit about brackets and bracket busting with our next guest, Tom Oates. That next, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at college basketball on the show now. March Madness is just around the corner. We're going to get a preview of the madness with Tom Oates, longtime sports columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal, and now co-hosts a podcast. It's called Wisconsin Sportscast, and he co-hosts that with Mike Lucas, another longtime sports writer in Madison. So it's great to have Tom with us. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Definitely want to talk about brackets. And I wonder, are you planning to watch the men's or women's NCAA tournament or both of them? Is it a kind of a tradition for you? Maybe you can talk about your favorite player or teams, and maybe you want some advice about filling out your bracket. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tom Oates, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. I all sports today with talking about lacrosse and now basketball.
You bet. We do that first Tuesday of every month. We set aside that time, Tom. I got to tell you a little story. I don't think I told it to you before. But when it comes to brackets, there was a time, and I'm not even sure I remember the year, but I always read your column in the Wisconsin State Journal, and I paid real close attention when you talked about brackets because you were really, you're very entertaining when you talk about brackets, and you always make picks. And one year there, you had a pick, and it was probably 20 years ago. It might have been Georgia Tech that year. Anyway, I looked at your picks, and I thought, the final two playing? That doesn't look right to me. It looks, you were taking a little flyer, I thought. But I thought,
in a while.
I thought, you know what, I'm going to follow your advice, and I took the final four you had selected, and then I backed them off to fill out the rest of the brackets, and then I entered that in two pools, and I won them both, and as a matter of fact, I was paid before the final game was even played because nobody else had both those teams in the final bracket. So I made some money on you. I guess I owe you a beer.
I think that check must have got lost in the mail that you sent me. So
I think the next day the column, your column after the game started with something like ahem.
No, you get lucky once in a while. If you like sports, it's a fun exercise, and you know it's something you can do with any and all of your office mates or friends or family or anybody. You know, you can do it at your favorite local watering hole. It's just somehow the NCAA stumbled on a really neat concept, which I think the 64 team NCAA tournament is. It's just there's a lot of drama. There's a lot of it's got all what you love about college sports: the tradition, the enthusiasm, and all that. And there's great competition, and you know, I think fans like to participate. And certainly a bracket thing is you know, I mean, some people really study it. Like, there's reporters out there that do all the math and, you know, probability and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, a lot of it is, you know, I love college basketball, so I watch it all year. So I have an idea about some of these teams. But whether you know a lot or not, it's just it's a fun exercise, and it's, you know, it's something you can follow over 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, and even if your own team isn't in there, if you fill out a bracket, you've got there's some rooting interest there then.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I never in my life would root for Duke, but, you know, if I have them in a pool, I'll root for Duke. You know, you got to look out for number one first, right?
Well, you know, I think back on the history of this, and it's not really that long a history, the bracket part of it, at least. I think it probably goes back maybe to the 70s.
Yeah, they expanded it. It was a small field. It started in 1939. The driving force behind it was a Ohio State coach, Harold Olson, who was actually a former Badger player. And Wisconsin won it 2 years later in 1941. But back then, it was an 8-team field. Now it's 68. But back then, it was 8. And there were, you know, 2 regionals. And then there wasn't even a Final Four. It was just a Final Two. And there were 2 4-team regionals and a Final Two. And then that expanded a little bit. But until the mid-1970s, they only took conference champions, and then they invited others that were there were a lot of independent schools back then, not in conferences. So what happened was Indiana had a great stretch in 75 and 76. They won back-to-back titles. And Michigan had a phenomenal team, but they couldn't beat Indiana. And so consequently, they didn't get in the tournament. And the same thing happened in the ACC. Maryland had a great team, with Len Elmore and Tom McMillan, later a U.S. senator, Maryland lost to, I don't know, Duke or Virginia, maybe somebody, Ralph Sampson, I can't remember, in the ACC tournament championship game, and they couldn't get into the tournament, even though they probably had the second best team in the country. So a couple of things like that really spurred the expansion of the tournament. And it didn't last. It went up incrementally, but very quickly. And by 1985, they had a 64-team tournament.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. And you know, when you think about when it comes to interest in the 60s, if you went back even a little further than that, I'm not so sure there was all that much interest. And certainly, if you're going to put together brackets, it wouldn't have been probably done because UCLA won every year.
Yeah, it was. I don't recall as a kid or even as a young adult that there were brackets. You know, there might have been 16, 18, 24 teams in the tournament or thereabouts. And UCLA certainly had a dominant run under John Wooden from, I think about 1965 to 75. They probably won 8 out of 11 or something like that. And, you know, they had Bill Walton, and before that, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I mean, and that was back when players of that caliber stayed in college for 4 years. So I think part of the appeal now is that you don't have a team like UCLA where if you get a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, you can dominate for 3 or 4 years. It's pretty wide open field, and generally speaking, and there's very few super teams anymore. The ones that recruit the guys that want to play 1 year and go to the NBA, the Dukes and the Kentuckys, they're still good, but you get a good veteran team against those young guys, and they've beat them. I mean, those teams haven't won that many titles in the last 10 to 15 years. So I just think there's a lot of interest now. I think the UCLA dynasty put college basketball on the map in many respects because TV didn't get interested in college basketball until Kareem, then his name was Lou Alcindor at the time, got to UCLA. And there was a seminal moment in college basketball in the 1968, when UCLA played Houston, who had a great player, Alvin Hayes. And UCLA played Houston, and it was in February, and it was on national TV, and it was a huge event. And that really kicked off the TV era, and then that morphed into expanding the tournament, and that morphed into office pools and stuff like that. And it's grown and grown and grown. It's just, like I said, it's a terrific sporting event. I'd like to say it was conceived by someone as it is now, but it wasn't. It was built piecemeal.
I read, it was in Smithsonian Magazine, that the first NCAA bracket pool, putting some money where your bracket is thought to have started in 1977 in a Staten Island bar, where 88 people filled out brackets in the pool that year, and they paid $10 to the winner.
That's the first one that anyone knows about?
That's the first. Well, from Smithsonian Magazine anyway.
And that's about when, I don't know, I'd have to look back, 1977. Well, that was the year Marquette won the championship, for one thing. But I'd have to look back and see how many teams were in the tournament. I would suggest it was somewhere between 26 and maybe 32, which as soon as it got to a number like 32 where you had to win 5 games to win the title, then all of a sudden, and the brackets got all evened out, then all of a sudden I think you could see the whole concept of a pool, office pool taking shape.
Yeah. Well, in that magazine, Smithsonian article, they said that first one paid out $10 and in 1977. And then at that same bar in 2006, 150,000 people entered, and the prize money exceeded $1.5 million.
Oh, my.
And apparently they got the bar got itself in a little bit of trouble with the IRS.
Well, I'd have to believe that maybe some of that publicity caused the IRS to raise an eyebrow. But, I think they would probably be very safe as long as they didn't pocket any of the money themselves. They just spread it out. But I guess the IRS might want to talk to the winner of that pool.
I would think so anyway. Oh man, Tom Oates, our guest today. We're talking about basketball and the NCAA tournament. Questions for him, you can give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And you know what, before we go any further, you have a podcast, it's called Wisconsin Sports, and maybe you can talk for a minute about that podcast.
Yeah, I do it with Mike Lucas, who was a longtime sports writer for the Capital Times, and then ended up working for the university. People will know him certainly as the longtime color analyst with Matt LePay on Badger football and Badger men's basketball radio broadcasts. And he did that. But he worked for the university as well on writing stories for their website. But they decided they no longer needed his services early last year. And he went back to writing a few columns a week for the Capital Times. And he approached me and said the Capital Times wanted to do a podcast. And so we started a podcast, about the beginning of the football season, I would say. And now it's called the Wisconsin Sportscast. And it's interesting. We've done some interesting things. And Mike, unfortunately, was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer in December. So he's talked about that on the show. And you know, we talked about the Howard Moore at Wisconsin. And but, you know, a lot of times we stick to sports. I know we're old, but that means, in my opinion, that means we've seen a lot.
Tom Oates is going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Tom. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, it's finally March, and that means March Madness. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio. The Badgers team, 18, the men, are 18-11 this season, currently sitting in fifth place in the Big Ten. Marquette is second in their league, but ranked, I think, eighth in the country. So their prospects are certainly looking a little bit better. Talking College Hoops with Tom Oates, a longtime sports columnist for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he now co-hosts a podcast with Mike Lucas. It's called The Wisconsin Sportscast, a great podcast. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with him. What are your thoughts about the basketball being played by either men or women and the NCAA tournament? Which team will you be following closely? Questions for Tom, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Buzz emailed us, Tom, and Buzz says it seems like the NIT was the major tourney back when he was young, so he must be an older guy, in the early 60s, and then the NCAA came on strong.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that's exactly what happened in the I think the NIT started maybe in the late 20s or 30s, 40s, and even into the 50s, they were competing tournaments. Now, there was one year when a team won both, but I think that ended that. And I think by about the mid-50s, the NIT had started to fall behind. There was the great Bill Russell era, which at University of San Francisco, where they won back-to-back championships in the middle 50s. And I think by then, the NIT had started to fade, and the NCAA became the more prosperous tournament. And that continued on and on. And by the time you got into full-blown March Madness, the NIT was great for a couple of schools I mentioned in that first segment, like Michigan and Maryland, which had probably the second-best teams in the country and couldn't get in the NCAA. They could go to the NIT. But when the NCAA started expanding in the 70s, it really was the death knell for the NIT, because now, you know, conferences could send 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever teams to the NCAA tournament, and it really diluted the field and the interest in the NIT. So, yeah, way back in the day, in the 30s and even in the 40s, and early 50s, I think there was a lot of debate over which was the better tournament. And I think early in that stretch, it was probably the NIT.
And I read somewhere that now Fox Sports is actually making some noises about maybe making an alternative tournament to the NIT.
The NCAA, the NIT was privately owned. It was started in New York in the 20s, 30s, 40s. Was really the New York City was the mecca of college basketball. And it was started there and was an invitational. But the NCAA now owns the rights to that, to the NIT. And so it's usually run in conjunction with the NCAA tournament. It stays out of the way of the NCAA tournament. But it's a place where teams that were good but not great or just missed the NCAA tournament or maybe had a really won their conference but didn't win their conference tournament and didn't get into the NCAA tournament. It's a place for them to go. But the NCAA now owns that. I'm not sure about Fox. I'm not sure what they're doing. I hadn't heard that. But the Badgers, you know, sadly, were in the NCAA NIT last year when they slumped down the stretch. And they actually won a couple, three games in that and finished off their season pretty strongly and gave them a nice springboard into this season. So, I think there's still some value and some interest in it, but it's way down the list compared to March Madness scale.
Rick in Belleville will give you a chance. Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Tom. So the show jogs the memory a bit, and I'm going to relate a little history and see if you guys want to comment. Back in 71, 72, I was up at Lawrence in Appleton, and Al McGuire and the team would come up to Neenah High School and do an exhibition. I think he probably did it elsewhere, but we would come down from Appleton, and as they walked into the gym, Al and Hank Raymonds walked in, and some of those team members you might remember. Bob Lackey, Jim Jones, Marcus Washington are names that come up. And I don't remember how far they went in the tournament that year. But fast forward a few years, and in 77, of course, he had the championship team and had Bo Ellis and some of the other great players. And he would always refer to his big center as his aircraft carrier, if you recall.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, the last time, I'm sure it was the last time Wisconsin had a national championship. So I'll throw that out to you, either of you, and see if that brings back any memories.
Tom?
Well, it brings back a lot because I went to Apple and Xavier, and when Al first got to Marquette in the middle 60s, our coach had played at Marquette, and Al brought his team and had exhibitions in the Xavier gym a couple times. And later on, it was Neenah with Jim Jones and Bob Lackey, the guys you mentioned. Al was a very colorful guy, one of the neatest people I've ever met in sports. And there's a whole history of Marquette in tournament play. They upset number one ranked Kentucky in the regional semifinal right down here at the UW Fieldhouse and just blew Kentucky off the floor when Kentucky had what everybody thought was an unbeatable team. That was in 69. And then in 70, Al didn't like his where the NCAA was going to put Marquette in the tournament, what regional, because he thought Adolph Rupp, the Kentucky coach, had directed where Marquette was going. So he said the heck with it and declined an NCAA invitation and went to the NIT and won it. And so there was that. And then, you know, a lot of people don't remember Marquette. Jones was gone. He went to the NBA. But a lot of people don't remember that Marquette reached the final in 1974. And lost to North Carolina State. North Carolina State had the famous upset of UCLA in the semis, and then they handled Marquette fairly easily. That Marquette team had Maurice Lucas and Bo Ellis and Marcus Washington, you mentioned. I think Larry McNeil was on that team. I'm not sure. Jerry Holman. Anyway, so Marquette was in the final in 74, and then they won it in 77. Bo Ellis was a senior that year. They also had Butch Lee and some other guys. Terrific team. But no, Wisconsin, the closest any Wisconsin team has come to a Division I national championship is certainly Wisconsin getting to the final against Duke in 2015 down in Indianapolis. So there have been a number of Division III championships in Wisconsin, yeah. I can tell you that. Whitewater,
Platteville,
Stevens Point, and four by Bo Ryan at Platteville. And Oshkosh has also won one. Or one or two, I'm not sure. And so, you know, let's not forget that I'm talking about D1 because that's really good basketball as well. But in terms of D1, yeah, it doesn't come around that often. There's a lot of schools. A lot of schools take basketball very seriously, and it's hard to do. And Wisconsin getting to – Wisconsin's been to three Final Fours since 2000, which is, you know – obviously, you guys remember that between about 1950 and about 1994, there wasn't a lot of postseason activity for the Badgers. So it's just nice to see that, you know, they're in the mix. They don't win it every year. Every couple of years they haven't even made the tournament, but by and large they've been in the mix. For making the tournament, and it's been, you know, a really interesting stretch in Wisconsin basketball.
It has been. I was on the UW athletic board when Dick Bennett took his team to the Final Four, and it's really exciting. And of course, went to the games in Indianapolis, and it is exciting to be there. But it's pretty darn exciting to watch it on TV as well. That's for sure. Rick, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Sandy called, couldn't stay with us. She wants to hear more about the NCAA Women's Tournament. And, you know, last year was, I think, a big year for the women's tournament. It really, big audiences. And this year, I think it's going to be as big or maybe even bigger with Caitlin Clark, her last time round for University of Iowa.
Yeah, women's basketball obviously had a late start in the mix. Generally started in the mid-70s, mid to late 70s at many schools. And the NCAA was not quick to embrace women's basketball. There was an organization called the AIAW, American Association of Women, or I don't even know what it stands for, but it was basically the NCAA for women, and they held multiple national tournaments at the time, and then at some point, I'm guessing very early in the 80s, and I don't know if this had to do with Title IX or not. But the NCAA got into the tournament business, and the AIAW pretty much went away. But it's grown. It's grown steadily. It's grown slowly. You know, it's like anything else in sports in America today. You have to get TV interested, or you don't grow your sport very well. And TV was. Wasn't all that interested at the start. There was a couple of star players that piqued interest back then. Cheryl Miller at USC was just a terrific, terrific player. But over the years, there have been either teams like UConn or Tennessee that have piqued people's interest, or individual players have piqued people's interest. And we're certainly seeing that now with Iowa and Caitlin Clark. And if Caitlin Clark has done one thing this year besides break every scoring record, she has gotten TV really interested in women's college basketball. And that's probably been a long time coming, but the interest surrounding Caitlin Clark has been phenomenal, and that's a credit to her, but it's also a credit to the improvement that they've made in the NCAA tournament, and not the NCAA tournament, and just NCAA women's basketball in general. The improvement has been steady, and the game, I think, is becoming more pleasing to watch. Even for hardcore men's basketball fans, it's become more pleasing to watch. And but again, it's Caitlin Clark has elevated everything to a new level. She's fun to watch.
Fun to watch and filled every stadium they played in.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, TV's been moving games around to clear space so they can get Iowa women's basketball games on TV. And you know what? That hasn't happened before. So kudos to Caitlin Clark. She's elevated the entire sport, and I think when she gets to the WNBA next year, she will elevate the WNBA. And I don't know that she's even going to be the best player in the league. She might not be, but she's the interest she's drawn and the fan appeal that she has will elevate the WNBA as soon as she gets there.
And this year for the tournament, Iowa's, I think the national rankings for Iowa, they're ranked sixth in the nation. South Carolina is first. I think Ohio State is second. So there's another Big Ten school ranked right up at the almost to the top. Texas, Stanford, Virginia Tech. I think that's the top five, and Iowa's sixth. And
yeah,
UConn
yeah.
is 10th. And UConn used to be just sort of an automatic first every year.
Yeah, UConn's fallen off the last three or four years. They have a terrific player, Paige Buecher, but she's had a couple of serious knee injuries. And I think it really has affected UConn over the last few years because she's a really – I think she's from Minneapolis area. She's a really good player. And but, again, her career's been affected by injuries. But, no, UConn's fallen off some. And you know, other – Tennessee used to be a superpower. They've fallen off some. Stanford has hung in there. That's a longtime power. One thing that's really helped college women's basketball, I think, is that it used to be dominated by two or three schools, UConn,
yeah.
Tennessee, Stanford. And now you're seeing many more schools taking the sport seriously. I think many more schools are drawing fans better than they used to. And you're seeing teams come up that you never would have seen. You know, Notre Dame's an example. They were really good, and they also caused a tremendous stir in the Final Four one year when Arike Igwebuki. I'm not sure. She's a Milwaukee young lady from Milwaukee. Ogunbowale, sorry. I got it right.
Yeah.
She's from Milwaukee, and she played at Notre Dame. And in the Final Four, she had back-to-back game-winning three-point shots in the two games. So
yeah.
That caused a tremendous stir. She's still a really good player in the WNBA. But that was about 5 years ago. That caused a tremendous stir. And I thought at that time created a buzz for college women's sports, but man, nothing like the Caitlin Clark show.
No, for sure. And there'll be a lot of eyes on that NCAA women's tournament. For the men, we look at the teams. I think Houston's ranked number one now. UConn, two. Purdue, I think, is third. Then Tennessee, Arizona. Marquette is eighth. Illinois is 12th. I know that. How are you seeing the tournament this year? It was funny. I was reading somewhere, and somebody said, well, you ought to pick a team that has some blue in their uniforms because 9 out of the last 10 winners had blue in their uniforms.
Well,
aside from that.
you know, there are people who pick, color of uniform when they do their pools. There are people who pick which mascot would beat up the other one and, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. But no, you've seen North Carolina wears blue. UConn has won titles. They wear blue. Villanova, they wear blue. Kansas, they wear blue. So yeah, that's probably a pretty good deal. In terms of this year, I think there's two teams that are head and shoulders above the rest. And UConn is the defending champion. And they had a few struggles early in the year, but since about mid-January, they have been just crushing people. They crushed Marquette the other day, and Marquette had a really good team. And then the other one is Purdue and UConn. Purdue's another team that I think is playing really, really well. They got a kid in the transfer portal that's really rounded out their scoring. And so those two, to me, I think are head and shoulders above everybody else. But, you know, that's the beauty of the NCAA tournament is if, you know, Purdue lost, their opener last year or either on the first weekend. And, you know, if you only have one or two great teams and they get upset, everything's wide open at that point. So I think those two are really good. I think Marquette's in line to be a two seed, which is terrific for them. If they can, I know they have some injury problems currently, if they can continue to win and do well and land on that two seed line, I think they'll get a favorable spot in the tournament and set themselves up for a run. You know, I think there was a time when Wisconsin was being looked at as a three seed and with a strong finish, maybe a two seed. Their recent struggles in the month of February have pretty much taken them out of consideration for the top, those top four seed lines are where you really want to be.
Yeah, they're probably going to be, well, who knows how the last few games are going to go, but they'll probably be an 8 or a 9, maybe somewhere in there.
Yeah, if they win a couple games here, I think they could still be in that 6-7 range. They have a really good resume, but it took a real tumble in February.
So you're thinking UConn or Purdue?
Well, I think UConn's loaded. I mean, they were really good at they came on late last year, and by the end of the year, they were just rolling, and they were hard. They were a hard team to beat, and they have most of their players back. And I really think they're probably the most complete team. I think Purdue has a couple of holes in its operation, but they have a 7'4" center and three great perimeter shooters around them, and they're not just perimeter shooters. They can all put the ball on the floor and make some plays off the dribble as well. So I think Purdue's got a really good team, but they might be vulnerable if Zach Edey, the 7'4" kid, gets in foul trouble, for instance. But Houston's good. There's a lot of teams like in that next group, I think. Marquette being one of them, that if they get healthy and get hot, they could go a long way in the tournament.
Tom, it's been a pleasure talking. Would you come back and be with us again sometime? I'd love to have you back.
Sure.
Oh,
certainly.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Tom Oates, his podcast is called The Wisconsin Sportscast. He does it with Mike Lucas. Thanks to him, and thanks to you for listening. Tomorrow, Scott Craven's back, a wildlife expert, and that'll be fun as well. In the meantime, you are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Larry Mueller.